You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is McMillan Powers, and I'm here representing Tamara Felicia Brown today. I do want to reserve about 4 minutes for rebuttal, if that's appropriate. Ms. Brown was convicted on a guilty plea with a sentencing agreement on January 30th of 2017 of a second-degree petty larceny and a trespass as a result of activities at a Walmart. The second offense, petty larceny, was a plea down from a third offense, which would have been a felony. And that is what really began the whole operation here. She pled guilty in order to avoid the felony convictions after conferring with counsel, and she thought that was in her best interest. The very next day, she comes back to counsel and says, I've made a big mistake because I've lost my job. I was working for the school board, I believe, in the city of Suffolk. And also, I've been told that I can't stay in my apartment, which was part of a subsidized housing arrangement. And so she then asked counsel to file a motion to withdraw her plea. The very next day, counsel does that. So within 2 days after the conviction, the motion to withdraw is filed. Now, the unusual thing about this particular case is that because it was a misdemeanor, the sentencing judge does not need and typically does not get a pre-sentence report and just enters a sentence right there, and particularly because there was a plea agreement with an agreement as to what the sentence would be. So she gets time with 12 months on the petty with 11 months suspended, and then she gets 12 months on the trespass with all the time suspended and everything's concurrent. That was the agreement. The very next day, though, she arrives at counsel and says, that's not what I thought was going to happen.
So then we get to the motion. Whether it's 1 day after or 10 days after or 5 months after.
Well, that is exactly what the issue is here, I think, in this case, because the way the statute is written. And that is the only reason I think that we have this problem, is because the statute says that a motion to withdraw may be made only before sentence is imposed or the sentence is suspended, unless to correct a manifest injustice, you can within 21 days after the entry of the sentence.
Let's say it's day 1 versus day 21. What difference does that fact make that you emphasize?
Here, only because she is a misdemeanant.
Why is that relevant either? We're going to change the law of manifest injustice because it's a misdemeanor order that has a conviction and a sentencing, as opposed to a felony order that has a conviction order and then 3 weeks later a sentencing order?
That's exactly what I would like.
I appreciate that.
I want to be candid. That's what I would like to see happen, because I think that what the General Assembly intended,
well, we're listening now,
was exactly what did not happen here. If you're sentenced, you're over, because usually you have the time, and the General Assembly understands that usually there's time between conviction and sentencing, do the report, do the background, and you can't change your mind after that sentencing comes down. Here, because it occurred simultaneously, it's not that she doesn't prevail on her motion so much. She doesn't really even get the choice, the chance to make the motion in effect on the just bare bones of the statute. And I don't think that the General Assembly, and I don't know that this court believes the General Assembly intended for this entire category of people, of defendants, who are misdemeanor people, never to be able to withdraw or to file a motion.
Can't they assert manifest injustice and actually show it?
Except for the fact that that is so much of a higher standard.
They have an opportunity, and you just can't.
And we can do that. And I think that we have here, and the reason I think we have here is because in the Justice case, the court said that Paris, which is the 1949 case, Justice is in 07, that's 58 years later. And 58 years later, they're now able to say that the Paris case is the seminal law. Well, it takes 58 years maybe for it to mature and become obviously the seminal law. I don't know. I think it was
this is Virginia.
No. This is in Virginia. It takes 58 years. But if that's true, what does Paris say? Paris says that if you have a misunderstanding of the effect, that then gets us to all these collateral consequences
Does Paris govern manifest injustice?
That language would seem to say that it would, but then we have a codification occurring in 1975 in which 3A 25 is codified, and now you get the manifest injustice language in the code, and then the very next case that comes along is decided, I think, is the Lilly case, is the very next one, and Justice Carrico writes the opinion that says manifest justice, injustice is now the law, it's codified, and so now there we are.
We have about 30 cases, many of which members of this court have written on the Court of Appeals, saying that manifest injustice is not Paris. It's after the conviction. It's a higher standard.
It is. It is. But what I'm saying is the way the statute is written that included the manifest injustice ignored the fact that there would be misdemeanor defendants who would get caught, as I look at it, between the comma and the semicolon. They get caught in that manifest injustice language. If that language is not there, then clearly she would be able to, under the old standard or under a more relaxed standard, of being able to show that she's in good faith making this request and she has some reasonable defense and there's no prejudice to the Commonwealth. And
what was her
clearly
reasonable?
Was able to show those three.
What was her reasonable defense?
Her reasonable defense, and I think that's highlighted in the appendix. If you'll look there at the appendix, I think it's page 30 in the appendix, when she says, "I took the plea to avoid the felony." She's very conscious that this third offense petty is going to be a felony. So she says, "I took the plea to avoid the felony. I didn't know what the circumstances would be, and that would make me lose my house and my job, so I took it. I do have evidence to fight against this case because I was not guilty. I have evidence to prove that the merchandise was left in the store and I had my money returned to me, and that's the reason I want to withdraw." So she is saying that she does have a reasonable defense. And
the defense is that the merchandise was left in the store?
That it was left in the store, she had money to pay for it, and that she was not involved in the petty larceny of these goods.
The offense itself doesn't require the merchandise to be taken from the store.
It doesn't, and she is not required to prevail on her defense at the motion stage. All she has to do is make a plain statement that there is some reasonable defense. The trial court is not to try the case there and come into the credibility of her or any other witnesses.
But that's my point. It's not a reasonable defense. Concealed merchandise charges do not require a person to leave the store with them. So what kind of defense is it that she didn't leave the store with them?
There's no evidence in the record. Let me make sure that we're looking here at the proffer. She was getting a cart. She was putting items into the bags and placing them in her cart that was not rung up. She's putting items in the cart. That's not yet concealment. So she's on the second petty larceny. But it's not clear how that evidence is going to come out as to whether or not there's any concealment.
That's the guilty plea proffer, right, that you just read?
Right.
Well, that's not what we're looking at. We're looking at her
and her
guilty plea.
And she
proffer.
Says, "I left the stuff there."
Well, why is that logically relevant? So what? Maybe she did.
But she's saying that I was pleading guilty to an offense that didn't really occur because I have this defense that I not only left the merchandise there, but I also have the money to pay for the merchandise, and I don't know, maybe she has something else to say about it later, but the full defense does not need to be put on at that motion hearing, and in fact, you can't do that. The trial court then is only looking at, is it in good faith, and I think there's no question that she was in good faith because she didn't understand the consequences.
As absolutely 100% true, it's not a defense.
It could. It can't. If she put the stuff in her cart and is charged with the petty larceny of the goods, and she doesn't leave with them, that's a defense. That is a defense to that petty larceny.
Not if she conceals it.
But what she is saying is she did not conceal them. She had them there, and they were not concealed.
Where'd she say that?
She doesn't say that, but there's no evidence that she concealed them.
It's her proffer. She's already pled guilty. The evidence that she's guilty is she pled guilty.
And that is exactly why she wants to withdraw the plea.
I thought she pled guilty to petty larceny.
Petty.
It wasn't a concealment.
Right, it's
charge.
Petty larceny.
So
and that's the point.
One, One thing I don't understand is she says something about money was returned to me. What was that about?
I'm not sure what that is in the way of her defense, but apparently there was some... it's not in the record, so I don't want to
okay,
say
don't,
I'm
making
don't,
this
don't
up. Okay, don't go into it. I just didn't
may,
understand. I didn't
understand
what that meant.
She may have tried to purchase the goods after she was stopped. I don't know.
Okay.
But I don't know. That's not fleshed out in any of the record.
And I took... What it sounds like to me almost what you're saying is she was saying, I didn't steal it.
I did not steal it.
Right. Because in her mind, since she left it at the store, she never left the store with it, she didn't steal it.
She did not steal it. As her defense, whether or not that prevails at trial is something else that she should be able to have the opportunity to prove and take to a jury if she wants, do whatever she wants to do in the way of a defense. But in this particular instance, because of the unique circumstances and the timing, she doesn't get that opportunity.
If what you're saying is true, then every single plea could be upset prior to manifest injustice, which I assume you realize is a very hard sell for you. You would be able to get rid of every single plea while a felon is waiting for a sentencing hearing and sitting around worrying about what's going to happen in that sentencing hearing just by walking in and say, honestly, I'm sorry, but the truth is I didn't do it. That would be enough under your logic.
Lilly says that you can't just, because you're unhappy with the sentence, you can't file the motion to withdraw. That's not what she did here, and it doesn't affect every person. If you look at this
only
has the
second,
effect.
Because I think what Justice Kelsey's talking about is not the instance where somebody is dissatisfied with the sentence. It's the instance when somebody's pled guilty and then they have regrets once they go into the jail and their buddies start talking to them, et cetera. And then they want to withdraw their plea.
The buyer's regret is real, but this is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a misdemeanor. We're not talking about the felons. The felons are going to be under the manifest injustice on a post-sentencing.
Well, let's play it out then. At the proffer for the guilty plea, the prosecutor says, this is a hypothetical, she walked out of the store with the stuff, didn't pay for it. She goes, yes, Your Honor, this statement's in fact true. Yes, Your Honor, you plead guilty because you're in fact guilty. Yes, Your Honor. And the next day she comes in and says, no, actually, I left things in there, and I'm not guilty at all. That would always be enough under your logic, unless I'm overstating it, to just take the plea away if you change your mind about anything.
That would only occur in these rare cases with the misdemeanors.
I think it would occur more in the felony cases because they have a good week and a half to sit around thinking about
it. They're going to be held to that higher standard. I'm getting into my rebuttal time, but they're going to get to that higher standard, and that's all we want to avoid here. We want to be able to put them in good faith.
But I thought you said a higher standard is only after they've been sentenced, right?
Right. And
hold up a second. We're talking about an instance when they have not been sentenced. Why wouldn't they be treated the same way you want us to treat your client?
If they come in at that point and want to have a hearing, they're going to have to convince the judge that just took the plea that he's made a mistake. I'm going to rest on the fact that that's a case I will rarely win at trial level. And it'll never get here.
You have a minute, 54
right,
seconds.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honor. Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. I guess the first issue would be, is this a post-sentence motion? The sentence had been imposed at the hearing. The order had not been entered. I don't think this court has yet decided which is applicable, whether this is in fact post-sentence because it's after the sentencing hearing, or pre-sentence because the order has not yet been entered. The Howell court found that such a the fact situation we have here would be post-sentence. And I think that makes sense if you look at the reasons for this distinction. And I think they're set forth most recently in Velasquez, that what we're concerned about is the person who takes the plea and then finds out that the sentence is something he didn't expect. He's disappointed, and therefore he asks for a to withdraw his plea. And, of course, you don't want that happen. You don't want to give him the easy standard that you would have pre-sentencing after he has discovered what his sentence will be at the sentencing. And we would suggest that because of that motive, that basis for the difference between the two standards, that it makes more sense to say once he has been sentenced in court, he then knows his sentence, and that same limitation, the termination of his ability to do it under the lower standard should terminate there. But I think in this case it doesn't really make any difference because, as the court has already, I think, shown, there is no basis under either standard for a withdrawal in this case. It's clearly not manifest injustice. This court, I think in Velasquez, cited Howell in the Court of Appeals, which said that what you had to show was an obvious miscarriage of justice, such as an involuntary guilty plea or a plea based on the plea agreement that had been rescinded. We have nothing like that here. The defense counsel admitted at the motion that all the steps had been followed at the plea, that the plea agreement was nothing wrong with the plea agreement, and that it was only that later on the victim discovered that, in fact, there would be collateral consequences to her plea.
Sorry to interrupt you, but Ms. Murphy, but in the Court of Appeals, didn't Brown concede that the that we're dealing with a post-sentencing?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the defendant conceded on brief here also.
Right. So while Howell is the law of Virginia at the moment, and I would argue a good explanation of the law, does it really matter to us? Because we don't have to address whether or not we technically agree with how or not.
Yes, sir. I mean, it is an issue that has sort of come up at times during the discussion in the court, and so I'm just bringing it to the court's attention. But we don't think you have to get to that. Certainly you can find both standards unsatisfied here.
May I ask you this? The Court of Appeals, in its opinion, said that the defendant's ignorance of the collateral consequences resulting from a guilty plea is not a basis for withdrawing it after sentencing because it does not constitute manifest injustice. Is that categorically true? I mean, in other words, there's a collateral consequence that a client may explore with a lawyer, maybe get wrong information. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court in habeas has dealt with immigration as one.
Yes, sir.
And, of course, this is tricky because there's so many collateral consequences that a lawyer can't possibly get into. Your neighbors may have your disapprobation now that you've been convicted. Well, the lawyer doesn't have to talk about that. But just a very broad statement by the Court of Appeals, and I wondered if that's actually categorically accurate, or might there be some situations where that would be a consideration in withdrawing a guilty plea?
Your Honor, I've submitted a number of federal cases which have dealt with this and have specifically addressed federal employment and housing because those are collateral consequences like those here. And in fact, the court has said, yes, it's only the direct consequences that have any relevance to the validity of the plea or with respect to determining a motion to withdraw. The collateral consequences of any kind do not render the kind of, are not required to make a valid plea and would not be sufficient to support a plea afterwards. Because you have to show that your plea was, even under the lesser standard, was inadvisedly made. And here that's not a possibility. And the fact that you didn't know about collateral consequences wouldn't affect that. Now, something like Padilla, where the court has now imposed on counsel a duty to examine the status of this defendant with respect to immigration laws is something different.
I mean, well, the scenario I was thinking is not a run-of-the-mill, I might lose my job or people might disapprove of me because of what I've done. But suppose a situation where someone says, well, if I plead guilty to this, will I lose custody of my children? That's the most important thing in the world to me, and it gets misadvice about that. And then, turns out that was wrong.
Well, that would certainly seems to me a habeas corpus matter. That, if the advice given was erroneous, then, in fact, you would have a situation where the defendant had been misadvised before entering the plea.
It may be the answer in this case is the type of collateral consequences we're talking about. I mean, making allowance for some kind of, extreme scenario that these collateral consequences don't really alter the equation, but
Mr.
that
Ron,
conceivably there might be some outlier case where they
sure.
won't.
I mean, I say they went with Padilla and said this is different. You have to really
and took everyone by surprise. I think.
Sure.
That's, you're talking about a Sixth Amendment issue there, whether or not the right to counsel, effective and competent counsel. You're not talking about guilt or innocence.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's no Sixth Amendment right to withdraw your plea at all. So,
yes, Your Honor. Well, what I'm saying is sometimes indicated that somebody who has received misadvice from an attorney prior to the plea may have a basis for withdrawing.
Well, to be sure, but I mean, in our case, I'm worried about the way you're wondering aloud as to whether or not it's categorical or not. If you're withdrawing a plea of guilty, aren't you saying, because I'm not guilty, and I got crummy advice or whatever, or I got overwhelmed, or whatever the argument is. It's not, well, I am guilty, but I don't want to go through a divorce proceeding, and if I get discharged, my wife's going to divorce me, or I'm going to lose custody over my child. Let's say it's real collateral consequences. Wouldn't all of those things be categorically off the table because they're not addressing the issue, which is, you came in here yesterday and told me you're guilty. Are you telling me you're not guilty today? No, I'm not telling you that. I'm just telling you I don't like being guilty.
Well, I think here the defendant did say that she was not guilty.
No, I realize that, but we're asking ourselves whether or not collateral consequences in the absence of a sufficient I'm not guilty argument or proffer could ever categorically by itself, which is what the Court of Appeals held, be enough. And tell me if I'm wrong, Ms. Murphy. I haven't seen a single case suggesting it ever could be by itself enough in federal or state law.
Well, I mean, I don't know of any other than the Padilla situation.
But that's a Sixth Amendment case. It's not a question of your right to withdraw a guilty plea.
Well,
it's your right to a Sixth Amendment competent counsel to tell you whether you should enter into
it. Right. Well, I think what I'm saying is that if, in fact, the court should determine that the collateral consequences are so significant that there wouldn't develop a Sixth Amendment right that you'd be advised.
Okay, let's suppose in our case, we have plenty of time. Suppose in our case, the collateral consequences of Padilla, which is you're going to get deported. You just pled guilty, you're going to get deported. And let's say there's no Sixth Amendment issue at all. For whatever reason, the lawyer prior to the decision to plead guilty told the guy exactly what he needed to know about that issue. He makes the call, and then he sits in jail for a couple of weeks and comes back in and says, you know what, I'm going to get deported. It's a huge collateral consequence. I'm going to lose my family. I'm going to disrupt my ability to take care of my children. It's really bad. I'm not saying my lawyer didn't do the right thing. I'm not saying I got tricked. But it's a huge collateral consequence. Well, Mr. Defendant, are you guilty? I'm not contesting my guilt. I'm just saying I would not have pled guilty if I had thought this through. How could that possibly be sufficient logically?
It wouldn't be sufficient, no question about it. I mean,
okay.
Here we have somebody who claimed that there was an inadvised plea because of the collateral consequences and has a defense. I mean, there may not be any defense, but she has alleged that she had if she had a substantive defense.
Right, so close the loop. Then that really means collateral consequences by themselves are never categorically enough. You have to always have a hook that goes to guilt or innocence.
Yes, Your Honor. You have to have a defense. I mean, you would get into the area exclusively of Sixth Amendment issues if you're saying,
right.
I wouldn't have pled guilty. I can't prove anything else. But we would, of course, have another issue of the prejudice, whether in fact a objective defendant would have taken back his plea and gone to trial if he knew about the immigration consequences. So we're a little trickier there, but. Yeah, certainly we're talking primarily here about someone who alleges a defense. You have to allege, and it's a substantive defense. If you look at the cases that have looked at that issue, the pre-sentencing cases, they have spent a good bit of time analyzing the defense, the same way the court has done here today, to determine whether or not it is a viable substantive defense. And here it is not. There's no claim that she wasn't putting the property into bags in a cart and then pushing out towards the entrance. Whether she actually left the court, the story is not important. And then she fled, and she left the items there. And I don't understand the reference to the money that she was given back. I mean, if she had paid for the goods. and she would have a perfect defense. And it's hard to imagine that she would have proceeded to a guilty plea if, in fact, she could somehow indicate that she'd given the store money, which they subsequently gave back to her. So I think that there's no viable defense at all. So, and of course, again, there's no indication that she pled inadvisedly. Everything that the attorney had to tell her he did, she wasn't entitled to advice on collateral consequences. So neither of the standards of tests is satisfied. And for that reason, I would request that the decision below be affirmed. Thank you.
All right. Rebuttal?
If there is no reasonableness to the collateral consequences argument, and if there is no reasonableness to the defense that the lady proffers at the time of the hearing on her motion to withdraw her guilty plea, then there's no need for the statute. Because if you cannot make a allegation in your motion, I have a defense, this is what it is, and it's bare bones, I'd like to present it. You can never withdraw a guilty plea.
And I think the question is, what is the defense? I mean, if it's mistaken identity, it's alibi, it's, I mean, in the, I think it was justice, it was who actually lived in the place that I supposedly burglarized. I mean, that's different than just, well, I never left the store or whatever.
But those would be circumstances that would be almost falling in the category of after-discovered evidence, which would be a reason for doing this. We're not talking about something that was discovered after the case is concluded. I now have someone who comes forward. Anytime you have a guilty plea, this court's been very clear about that, and I've litigated guilty pleas futilely. This is a self-supplied conviction, and so the withdrawal of the guilty plea almost is such a rarity. But in this particular instance, and this is the point, in this particular instance with the misdemeanor, she doesn't get the chance to do that because as soon as the conviction occurs, she then falls into the higher standard and she never gets to show good faith alone and a reasonable defense. She now is bumped up into showing manifest injustice. I see my time is out. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Call the next case.